I'm Jeff Cohen. Dr. Stuart Chesner is a clinical psychologist who transformed his childhood struggles into a lifetime career. Chesner felt like an underdog as a child, which fueled the desire to find his spiritual path, achieve personal success, and help others do the same. Dr. Chesner, welcome to Saturday to Shabbos.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
I love interviewing people who had something going on in their childhood, something they were struggling with, and they figured out how to turn that into their career. So it's admirable that you're able to do that.
I think it's important to say that as I was taking the steps of figuring it out, I had no idea that I was figuring it out. I mean, I'm 64 years old now, and it's only at this point that I think I really have some insight into what was going on in all of my life.
That's pretty common, as I've done a lot of these interviews, that people don't realize along the way how all the steps fit together into this intricate puzzle. And now looking back on the journey, they can see the importance of each thing that happened and how it fits together.
Yeah, I think if you're a person of faith, it really enhances your faith because you can really see in retrospect the hidden hand. You've been guided at many points in your life, and at many of the points along the way have really determined the personal and unique meaning of your life.
And let's now dive into those points that made you who you are today. And we'll start at the beginning, even before we talk about your own story. Tell us a little bit about your parents and their backgrounds to set the stage for you coming into the world.
Like many of us, my roots are in Eastern Europe. My grandfather, my father's father, was born in Chelm. My father, too, was born in Chelm. There really was a major thriving Jewish community in Chelm that was totally wiped out by the Nazis. But my grandfather, for some unknown reason, when my father was just an infant, turn of the 20th century, he moved from Chelm to Odessa. And he got to Odessa in about 1910. And in Odessa, he was promptly drafted into the Tsar Nikolai's army. At that point, the draft for newcomers was 18 years, and as many good Jewish boys did, he deserted the Tsar's army, somehow made his way from Odessa to Germany, got on the USS Hamburg, and arrived on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, Ellis Island, where he was met by two of his landsmen from Chelm, who signed off on the papers, and he came to America, leaving behind my grandmother and eight children. Then it took about 10 years until my grandmother had collected enough money in order to get the entire family over from Odessa to the United States. The way they did this was that my grandfather was sending a photograph. Every month he would send the same photograph. And the first one they put up on the counter. Second month, they thought maybe he's just too busy. He forgot that he sent the same photograph the previous month. Third month, they get the same picture. So my father's older brother, Morris, Moshe, he was called then. So Moshe, then photographs were thick. He opened up the photograph and he saw inside each photograph was a $10 bill. My grandfather was sending the money over. At that point, there was a treaty between the United States and the new Soviet Union that if you had first-degree relatives living in the United States, so the family from the Soviet Union was able to immigrate to the United States. And they emigrated from the Soviet Union, and my father came to the Lower East Side of New York. The first thing he did when he got off the boat, he saw this Jewish guy with in the black clothes of a chassid, with tzitzis hanging out and with payas and a beard. And he said, at this point, my father was about 12 years old, 11 years old. And he says to his older brother, Maisha, look at that dirty Jew over there. And Maisha promptly smacked my father in the side of the head and said to him, Schmeckel, that's your father. And that was the first time my father actually saw his father. But again, it speaks to the difference. And my father grew up basically under the communist revolution, where told me that my grandmother used to light Shabbos candles and then immediately blow them out because she was fearful that, you know, neighbors would report on them. And so my father really came not having any background in religion. He went out, immediately began working 7 days a week on the Lower East Side, eventually had his own business and thrived in the New York Garment Center. And my mother's family came from Hungary. They were already in the States. My mother was born already in Scranton, Pennsylvania. You know, I grew up in what was basically a schizophrenic kind of Jewish home, in the sense that we had two sets of dishes, Fleishig and Milchig dishes, but there was really no observance. Shabbos wasn't Shabbos, holidays weren't holidays. We would eat out in Chinese restaurants, or I remember Peter Luger's steakhouse. My father was very proud, and mother were very proud Jews, but I'd say Orthodox non-observant Jews is how I would describe them. We lived in Borough Park. You know, it was a highly Jewish area. And I went to Jewish day school, but we had no level of observance.
You use this phrase, schizophrenic childhood. I'm thinking how the head of school where my kids go, he always tells us, if you're not consistently doing at home what we're teaching the kids in school, it's going to be very tricky for them. And it sounds like that's exactly what was happening for you.
Yeah, because I guess even more tricky, because I saw great Jewish pride from my parents. They sent me to a Jewish school. I thought that was important enough. Well, my father would often say to me, he wanted me to have what he did not. And he grew up not having an opportunity to have Jewish education. And then I'd be able to choose however I would want. I speak much more about my father than I do about my mother. That's because, unfortunately, my mother died in 1963 when I was only 4 years old. So I really don't have any memories of my mother, just pictures and stories.
Well, I'm really sorry to hear that, because the way you were starting to describe your family, okay, there's this schizophrenic aspect to it, but it could also have been a very loving two-parent home. And then to have this happen when you're so young that you don't even really have memories of her, what was that like for you? After she unfortunately passed, what was it like within the family going forward?
I am the youngest of three children, and I was apparently an afterthought and somewhat of a mistake. It seems I came 12 years after my brother. When my mother died, so in many ways, a lot of my caretaking was taken over, mostly by my sister and her husband. My sister had recently married, and my brother and my father, they all chipped in. So even though I had all my physical needs cared for, I felt really something was missing. I think that's something that I've carried with me throughout my whole life.
When you use this phrase that something is missing, I would think that often leads someone to start searching. You say something's missing. I need to find what's missing. How am I going to go about doing that search? So were you going through some of those thoughts, and what did you start to explore?
Well, I didn't go through the thoughts, again, consciously. I didn't have any thoughts of exploring something. But, you know, the story goes that when I was in sixth grade, I went to a school that was called Eitz Chaim in Borough Park. No longer exists now. The Eichler Bookstore is where it used to be. But I went to Eitz Chaim, and in sixth grade, I saw these two other kids from my class were looking at this brochure for Camp Morasha, Yeshiva University's camp. And I remember looking at it, and they were saying we're going there this summer, and it looked kind of cool to me. So I went to Camp Morasha for the summertime. I was 10 years old at the time. It was the first time that, although I was like really taken aback by how religious the place was, that like, I mean, I had never experienced that, you know, Shabbos, where you really are restricted and they don't have regular sports. I was taken aback by religious people having fun. I saw Jewish families there, and the family seemed to be together, and people were singing, and people were dancing. And to me, this was cool. It was interesting. I ended up going back to that camp for 10 summers, from the age of 10 till the age of 20, where I was a staff member and a counselor. And over that time period, when I was about 14, 15 years old, I started becoming more observant, actually. I started like internalizing it more as an alternate way of life, which really is quite fitting. And again, you speak of filling a void. I think a void of tremendous loneliness. It was filling meaning. And now in retrospect, that also, I can also say a connection with my mother, because, you know, once you become observant and you take on the beliefs of having an afterlife, I really felt connected in spirit with my mother.
Now, you're learning things in school and you're also seeing it play out in camp. So as you're taking on the mitzvahs, are you just adopting things that you're learning and saying, that makes sense, this makes sense, I'm going to incorporate into how I'm living and just sort of go slow and steady that way?
Again, I had a big advantage that from kindergarten, I went to yeshiva. So I felt like I knew a lot of stuff. But the biggest thing for me at that point in life was Shabbos and Kashrus. And I remember having to say to my family that, you know, I don't want to really travel on Shabbos. And that was, you know, uncomfortable. Kashrus, we always, quote, kept kosher in the house. Out of the house, it was like, do whatever you want. But in the house, it was a kosher home, so to speak. And by the way, even as I grew more and more observant, I would always eat in my father's house, in my sister's house. I would always eat there, even though, you know, one could say, you know, is it really kosher? Is it not? But, you know, I felt for the sake of Shalom Bayis, it was much more important just to be part than rather break that up. So, again, I think I was very lucky in the sense that I really didn't get too much negativism. In fact, I always felt my father was quite proud of me taking the religious route, even though he was really not observant in most ways.
Now, something I said in the introduction is that you're a clinical psychologist. So shifting gears, you've talked about this exploration you're doing in the search for meaning that you're finding in Judaism. Does that also play into the career path choice as college approaches and you think about what you want to do?
Certainly, yes. But I didn't have a clue, I mean, in terms of what really was motivating me. I went to Yeshiva University and I had the privilege of learning with Rav Soloveitchik at Yeshiva University. And I decided that I wanted to become a rabbi. And at that same time, I had also taken a position. I was the youth director at Congregation Kilat Jesher in Ramaz School in New York City. And I was dating the administrator of the school was Dr. Noam Shadavsky, and his daughter was Rachel Shadavsky. I was dating her, and, you know, 42 years ago, we got married. But I remember before we married, I went to my father-in-law. In those days, that was the norm. I don't know if it is today anymore, but, you know, in those days, you would go and formally, at least, ask permission for the daughter's hand in marriage. And so I went to Noam Shadavsky, and I said, I would like to marry your daughter, Rachel. And he said to me, oh, that's very nice. So how do you plan on supporting her? I said, I'm going to be a rabbi. He said, and where are you going to live? I said, I'm going to live in Israel. I'll never forget, he said to me, well, you know, that's kind of like bringing snow to the Eskimos. You know what I mean? And he said, maybe you'll consider getting a profession. You can always study Torah and, you know, teach Torah if you want. Maybe you can get a profession. And I guess I didn't really want to be a rabbi that much because it was like a no-brainer for me. I just thought in my head, what's a secular version of a rabbi? And I said, oh, it's a psychologist. So I remember I decided I was going to be a clinical psychologist. And so I took all of my psychology courses in 1 year. I ended up spending an extra year at Yeshiva College because of that. I spent 5 years getting my bachelor's degree because I needed to take the psychology courses, and I took the boards. And I think because I had just recently learned all of the material in psychology over the past year, so I did very well on the boards and I got accepted into a program, went out to Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, Ohio, and studied there through my master's and my PhD. We lived in Cleveland for 10 wonderful years until we moved to Israel in 1991 with that then was three of our children. You know, we had three kids born then, and here in Israel, we've added on another three. And now we have a whole tribe of grandchildren here as well. But I want to tell you, when I chose to be a psychologist, I went to my father and he said to me, Simcha, what does a psychologist do? And I said to him, well, you know, psychologist talks with people, listens to people. He goes, do you give them anything? And I go, not really. He goes, you give them drugs or something, medicine? I go, no. He goes, and they pay you for that? And I said, yeah, Dad, they pay you. He says, good, smart boy, what a racket. That was, you know, my dad's understanding of what it was. But we were in Cleveland till 1991. I received my doctorate in 1987. And in 1991, we made Aliyah to Israel. But, you know, what I personally did in my professional life of becoming a clinical psychologist, I found I've always worked with people who in their own way felt kind of down and out, felt like outsiders or not really parts of the mainstream crowd. An area that I focused particularly in is the area of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, where I worked with kids who were smart, but although they were smart, they were really and are really misunderstood and mislabeled and mishandled by so much of the Torah community. And I'm quite certain today that the reason why I gravitated to this area was that I really saw so much of myself in these type of children.
I'm thinking about this specialty that you found that today everybody knows these terms, ADD, ADHD, but I would think at the time that you were beginning your investigation of them and meeting with kids that you thought were dealing with things like this, did it even have a name?
It had a name and very few people knew the name. In the United States, it was just becoming a thing, ADHD, which is about the 10th name for the same disorder over the past 120 years by the scientific community. So, you know, it's confusing for people what it is. But in Israel, nobody knew what it was. And, you know, many people today here in Israel say, I brought ADHD to Israel. You know, they say it in a half-joking way. Before I came, there was no ADHD. Now, suddenly, you know, every other kid has ADHD. But although I don't believe that I personally have ADHD, but I have a lot of the characteristics on the outside of ADHD. In my case, I believe it came from anxiety of feeling very vulnerable and not feeling protected. And so I think I was always running around doing a lot of things not to have to cope with my own anxiety and fears. And I was a bad kid. I went to Yeshiva of Flatbush to high school. I do have a diploma someplace from the Yeshiva of Flatbush, but I was rarely there in the sense that I would often find the streets of Manhattan to be much more interesting than the school. And I was what you would say today, I was a youth at risk. That's the other group that I do a lot of work with here in Israel is youth at risk. I do a lot of work with the Ethiopian community here in Israel. You know, I started a program in the city where I live, Ma'ale Adumim, called Magen, which is in Hebrew, which is for Moach, Guf, and Nefesh, you know, mind, body, and soul. And it's really trying to strengthen these youth at risk before they get into too much trouble and help them develop a strong identity of what they are in Israel. And again, in retrospect, I'm quite certain that, you know, I see a piece of myself in each of these Ethiopian kids and youth at risk in general.
Now, you just jokingly said that people tell you you came to Israel and you brought ADHD with you, but you also created many of the solutions in Israel that people are following when they are dealing with kids who have ADHD. So I just wanted to give you a chance to talk about a few of the other initiatives and ways that you've gotten involved in trying to help people overcome this.
Well, you know, I started a network of schools here in Israel for kids who have ADHD. They were 7th through 12th grade. They were called B'nai Chayil. They are schools that took kids who have average or even superior intelligence, but who were literally either expelled or about to be expelled from their regular school system because of their ADHD, which at that point was really not treated and not understood. And these kids were really viewed as embarrassments to their family and bad children. And you know, we basically see these children as potentially people who have tremendous skills if you can turn them in the right way. You know, one of the things that I often speak about is that I view these kids as very similar to King David, to David HaMelech. You know, David HaMelech is referred to as an Admoni in the Bible, an Admoni, a fiery redhead, whatever that means. There's only one other biblical figure that's referred to as an Admoni, and that is Esau. It's kind of interesting that Esau in the Jewish tradition has been branded as the sign, the symbol of evil, and yet David is viewed as the same basic temperament, and I feel that we're really talking about the ADHD temperament, and how these kids are going to turn out is really dependent on how we're able to direct them, the kind of education we're able to give them, and if we're able to build up a positive self-esteem and a positive sense of identity, as opposed to identity confusion, then we can have these kids become wonderful. I think, you know, we have a hard time with all of the potential King Davids among us. We do a pretty good job with the other kids that are more straight shooters. But the people like King David, who are multifaceted, multidimensional creatures, very passionate, very emotional, very artistic, very creative, I think that we, as the Jewish community, don't deal with them as well. In my most recent adventure, I would say, is that I wrote a book together with Dr. Sarah Markowitz that is called Kosher ADHD. And it's a book that is really about surviving and thriving within the Torah observant community with ADHD. And what we are really focused on doing now is bringing this to the wider Jewish community, and particularly the community in the United States of Torah observant people who are challenged with an ADHD child or who themselves have ADHD and are trying to live Torah observant lives and have, in my opinion, tremendous things to offer, but can often feel like they're simply losing their minds.
So you just mentioned this book, Kosher ADHD, that you co-wrote, and the fact that you co-wrote it tells me that there's a co-author, and I happen to know who that co-author is because Dr. Sarah Markowitz happens to be the Rebbetzin in the very community where I live. So I thought it would be nice to bring her into the show now so you can talk about the book together. So Dr. Sarah Markowitz, welcome to Saturday to Shabbos.
Thank you so much for having me. It is a privilege to be on. We are very proud of this podcast.
And Dr. Chesner just talked a little bit about the book, and I want to give you a chance also to explain to our listeners how the idea came about, how you found each other, and why you wrote the book.
Dr. Chesner actually came to me. We go way back from when I had been working in Israel, when my husband was learning in the Griskola for YU after we had been married for a little while, and I was trying to figure out what to do. And I had the distinct privilege of doing research in the school that Dr. Chesner ran, Matara, for boys with ADHD. And because of that, I actually went into the field. Fast forward 17 years later, Dr. Chesner reaches out, and our families had gone way back. That's how I knew him. And he reached out and he said, "You want to write a book?" And even though I often say yes to most things, I said, no, it would be taking on too much. This is a lot. Like, you will write a wonderful book. And then he appealed to my sense of mission on behalf of the Jewish community. And he said, there are so many people, Jewish children and families, who are suffering because children who have ADHD are really not succeeding in the Jewish community. And the truth was, and is that I had spent probably the last 2 weeks from when he asked me, my husband and I had been meeting with a lot of families who are really struggling with their children. And I spoke to my husband and my children. I said, we're going to take this on and it can be really meaningful. And they were on board. And that is how we ended up doing it. It is a tremendous privilege. And the book has been very well received beyond our imagination. And Dr. Chesner is really an expert in the area, and he was correct. We have to bring this internationally, outside of Israel, outside of what has been done, and find ways that we could incorporate this in the community so it could really be used to strengthen people's observance and love of Yiddishkeit and not turn them off.
I know we have a lot of listeners who tune in because they want to hear inspiring stories about how someone became observant, like Dr. Chesner just shared, but they also may be listening and thinking, wow, I also have a kid who's struggling. And so now they know there's this book out there, Kosher ADHD, that they can get. But what message would you have for parents who are listening right now and thinking, man, I really do have a child who I think has ADHD, or they've been diagnosed and we're really struggling? What's like a first step they should be doing as they're trying to deal with this?
Well, I think the first step is seeing the positive in their child. We speak of 5 P's. If you want to work with ADHD, we all have to take 5 P's upon ourselves. It's a 5-step process. The first P is perspective. Parents have to take the right perspective on not seeing their kid as lazy, stupid, unmotivated. Well, parents, children, rabbis, which it's really hard to do. For some reason, we seem to have a lot of sensitivity in our generation to kids who have learning problems, which is good. Maybe 100 years ago, a person who couldn't read, everyone thought he was lazy. But when a child has problems sitting still, controlling his impulses, whether it's being in shul for 2 hours or 3 hours on a Shabbos morning, or sitting around the Shabbos table, or not wreaking havoc on Purim, which we know is coming up really soon. All of these things are connected to behavioral issues, to a biological temperament, which if we can understand it and we can redirect it and be educators, then we have to educate these children. We have to help them use their strengths to fit in and minimize their weaknesses. I think that that is the first step, and that's our first P, is perception, perspective.
The more people who are your listeners, your very faithful listeners, really understand what it is, right? As Dr. Chesner is saying, and understand what executive functioning is and the parts of the brain that will do well in certain environments and not well in other environments, they can begin to have a perspective that is more empathic. It's not that these people don't want to do well. Jeff, imagine I came over and I dropped off a lot of pipes and I said, okay, can you just build the plumbing for this house right now? I'm going to be back in a little bit. I'm going to make sure that it's okay, right? You would feel overwhelmed and pressured and like a failure, unless you might actually have a skill set that I don't know about.
That is not one of the skills, no. I appreciate that you think maybe I do, but for sure not.
You do have a lot of skills. I feel like you'd probably find a way to delegate and get it done real quickly, circumventing the challenge that is ADHD. For these children and adults, this is what it feels like when we ask them to do basic things, like, can you not speak to the person next to you? Please don't like touch what it is that you see. And it seems very disrespectful, right? Teachers, parents, anyone, grandparents, they just look and they're like, it's so offensive. You're so chutzpahdeh, you know, and it is the last thing that they are trying to do. It doesn't mean they get out of jail free card. The question is how do we really understand what they're up to and have empathy? And then we get to the rest of the P's. But if we see ourselves as these wise guides that can help them, we are really going to allow them to connect to Yiddishkeit on a different level.
You want to keep going on the P's? Now that you said there are 5, you got to give us the whole list.
So after perspective is plan, you have to make a plan. You can't just wing it. If you plan, and the plan means you think, what are realistic expectations? How can I break the task down into a way that it will be doable for this child? Because if I just tell him to clean up his room, he'll look at his room and say, it looks clean to me. And then you get angry at him. So we have to plan what we expect. And then we have to, the next P is practice, the adult and the child, or the adult has to practice the steps that you planned. And then there's performance is the next P. And then after performance, there is praise. The final P is praise. It is really important to be wowed and marvel and be amazed at what these kids have done. And not just take it for granted that, well, anybody can do that, because if your brain is not wired in the right way, and so executive functioning is not your strong suit, well, then these things are going to be very hard for you. And each of our brains are very, very different. Once an ADHD kid said to me, Dr. Chesner, you know, one day I'd like to do a brain transplant with you. I'd like to just, if you were to put my brain in your head, then you would understand how hard it is for me to sit through history class. I remember I said to him, that's great. Maybe one day the technology will be there and I'd be happy to do the brain transplant. But he said to me then, yeah, but there's one hitch. I go, what's that? I want my brain back afterwards. I was insulted. I said, what's the matter? You won't be happy with my brain? He said to me, well, yeah, I'm sure you know you're smart, you're a professor, and you write books and all of these things, but I'm quite certain that my brain is much more interesting than yours is.
Wow.
I'll never forget that, you know, little conversation of many, many years ago.
From a Baal Tshuva perspective, so on the one hand, it's actually a really great way to help ADHD, because when you have found something that you are passionate about and you connect to, that actually helps a brain that is really usually bored get really pumped up. I think one of the best ways is if someone, even if someone's from, if they can become like a Baal Tshuva and see themselves as even growing more, it's an antidote to what an ADHD brain is like. Really, when things are boring, it's really hard, right? Like the roteness of certain things could be very difficult. So keeping that Baal Tshuva perspective, the flip side is a parent of a child or a spouse of someone who is now, you know, has already become religious, and then they have a child with ADHD who is not fitting into the system. So if it seems like a very personal, I mean, even if you're not a Baal Tshuva, it seems very personal, right? And the more that we can understand that this is not about what Torah and Judaism is giving us, it's really about what the challenges are in an environment. But if we can pair people up, again, just having in mind how a person who needs this stimulation and meaning, they can get that through reconnecting in Yiddishkeit. And that's something we want to think about, that our child really needs, that new level of like, wow. And we have it if we didn't grow up with that. But if you grew up with it, it's a challenge and something I think we can do in some ways if we learn from the way that the ADHD brain is made up.
Given that the book is called Kosher ADHD, it makes me wonder, is there some difference for a family that will be going through this with their kid in a secular environment versus in the yeshiva system? What is it about having ADHD and being in the Jewish environment that might make it different?
I think the Torah environment has a tremendous amount of rules and regulations. Learning is emphasized on a certain level, learning of Torah, which means being able to sit through shiurim, which may be pretty low stimulation environments. Shabbos, where your amount of physical activity is very, very limited. Everyday tasks such as tefillah, praying, where usually we don't get immediate results from our prayer. I mean, I don't, at least, you know, usually it doesn't come down from heaven, whether I'm asking for money or for health, it doesn't change immediately. These things are really, really hard for ADHD children. And I think that Dr. Markowitz said something really profound when she made the differentiation between a Baal Teshuva and a person who is from birth, as they say. And that is that, you know, it really explains when Chazal say, Bimkom Shebaalei Teshuva Omdin Ein Tzadikim Gemurim Yicholim La'amod, that the place where Baal Teshuva stands is a different place, a higher place than the place of a tzaddik. Think that anyone who is a Baal Teshuva, by definition, at least at one point in your life, you had tremendous passion for Torah observance. And that passion, even if you have ADHD, if you have passion, the passion overcomes the slow pace, the lack of stimulation, what might be perceived as somewhat boring and limiting. But the fact that you have that passion, now you're Baal Tshuva, now you're going to raise your child as from birth, well, he may not have that passion that you do, but he certainly has your genes, which means there's a pretty good chance he's going to be ADHD also. And so to help all these Baalei Tshuva parents who look at their children who don't have the same appreciation and wonder and passion for Yiddishkeit, it's really, really important to focus on that perspective of where the child is coming from as opposed to where you came from.
So we know our listeners can pick up a copy of Kosher ADHD as a first step in learning more about this and beginning to tackle it with their kids. How else can they reach out to either or both of you if they want more than just the book? How else can they get in touch with you and get more involved in what you have to offer?
We have a website that is kosher-adhd.com. where there are a lot of articles, particularly about living within the Torah community, from community, and trying to be observant with ADHD. We offer parent training groups virtually via the internet, and we are offering a webinar on March 10th at 9 o'clock in the morning, Eastern Standard Time, on turning Purim into a meaningful day, transforming mayhem into merriment. And what we hope to do is continue with these webinars before each of the Chagim. We'll have one before Pesach too, God willing. Really, how do you deal? How can this be transformed into a day that's really a holiday, a day of thriving and holiness for a person with ADHD? And if it's either you as an adult or one of your children in the family. And we're trying really to create now an international community of Jews with ADHD who are traditional, who are committed to Torah life and want to contribute to be a part of the team.
Yeah, we'll also be doing some workshops for adults because there are many adults who struggle with ADHD also. It looks different. Sometimes you can look at a woman or a guy and you're like, oh, they just don't have their act together, man. Like, can't they keep track of their kids' shoes and, you know, like always the last minute invitations on Shabbos and like, is Shabbos really going to start? Hashem clearly knew 18 minutes. You know, are made for certain people, especially. It is like the saving grace. We're still determining the name. Maybe it's going to be like an Eishes Chayil or B'nai Chayil, but a way for women and men separately to have this community to really work on certain skills to be able to really take care of Shabbos and Yontif and holding a household and having chavrusas or managing things in your life, really applying things that are helpful and skills, but really helping to build it into a Jewish communal framework. Community is actually the answer in a lot of ways. Accountability is extraordinarily helpful. For some reason, some brains are just like, oh, I have something I want to do and I'm just going to do it. And other brains, it doesn't work like that. I could want to do it. And the ability to follow through is really something that is not so easy. And you have to kind of work the environments. And I have found that chavrusas in life, chaburas in life, right? Groups. And this is really a way when we're all in this together in these areas and we're specifically working on certain things, real change can be made.
Most importantly, as I'm hearing you talk about the book and all the tools that you have, something that you're accomplishing is taking a topic that people may have been either embarrassed or afraid to talk about, and you're bringing it right into the mainstream and saying, let's deal with this as a community. Let's not be afraid to face it head on and help our kids be successful. So I think it's just beautiful that you've written this book together. Dr. Chesner, I loved your story. Sarah, thank you so much for joining us to talk about the book. And thank you to both of you for joining me today on Saturday to Shabbos.
Thanks very much. It's great to be here. It's not often that I get to really see how my personal life journey and my professional life are really intertwined. And having that insight is very, very valuable and enriches me both personally and professionally. So thank you again for this terrific opportunity.
Thank you so much for having me. It is a tremendous privilege to be on this podcast and also to express mine and my husband's tremendous gratitude and real awe of Jeff Cohn for everything that you do on behalf of our personal community in Fairlawn and what you're doing for Klal Yisrael. And we, those people in life that you're around to help you grow, you're one of those people. And I'm so happy that the larger community has access to you. So continued hatzlacha and bracha.
Saturday to Shabbos is produced by Gary Wallach. Our theme music is by Paul Uden. To learn more about us, please visit tachlismedia.com. That's tachlismedia.com. Tell us what you think about what you've heard, or suggest a story we should know about by emailing shabbos@tachlismedia.com. I'm Jeff Cohen. Thanks for listening. Please check with us often for more stories of inspiring Jewish journeys. Saturday to Shabbos is a Tachlis Media podcast.